This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thank you for streaming or downloading this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. If you're new, you can listen to brand new episodes every Thursday. Just subscribe to get automatic updates. Today we're taking a close look at one of the people behind the Gunpowder Plot and his family home, which is in the care of English Heritage. His name was Francis Tresham, and the property was Rushton Triangular Lodge in Northamptonshire. But what was Tresham's role in the Gunpowder Plot? What does Rushton Triangular Lodge tell us about religious persecution and Catholic resistance? And how can you pay your own visit? Well, with us to answer those questions and many more are Dr. Elizabeth Norton, a historian specialising in Tudor history.
Hello.
And English Heritage Properties historian, Dr. Andrew Roberts.
Hi, Charles.
So let's get to the basics of the Gunpowder Plot for any domestic or even international listeners who aren't quite familiar with this period of English history. Elizabeth, can you describe what the Gunpowder Plot was?
The Gunpowder Plot, I mean, it's famously commemorated by the rhyme, "Remember, remember the 5th of November with gunpowder, treason and plot." And I mean, that sort of basically sums it up, is that it was a plot by some Catholic Englishmen to blow up the king at the state opening of Parliament, to blow up the Houses of Parliament and everyone in there. And it was going to take place on the 5th of November, 1605.
How many plotters were involved in this? Because the person that history and popular consciousness tends to remember is, of course, Guy Fawkes. But there's more than just one guy, isn't there?
Absolutely. So when we commemorate Bonfire Night, we think about Guy Fawkes and you can buy his mask. But he's actually not even the top plotter. There are 13 members of the plot. About four or five are really key members. And Guy Fawkes is probably about the third or fourth in that list. The leader of the plot is Robert Catesby, who is a Northamptonshire gentleman. He is a Catholic. He's born into a Catholic family, although he seems to undergo a religious experience in his early 20s where he really becomes very fervently Catholic and wants to turn England back into a Catholic country. So he gathers together these plotters, including one Guy Fawkes, who's actually recruited for his military experience. He is also a Catholic. In fact, he actually is lower ranking than most of the other plotters. Most of them are gentlemen, but Guy Fawkes is the son of a lawyer from York, converts to Catholicism in his teenage years, and then really becomes very, very fervent. And he is serving with the Spanish Catholic troops in the Netherlands when he is recruited to the plot.
Obviously, of course, Elizabeth, one of those plotters is Francis Tresham, who we're going to speak about in a bit more detail later. But I suppose the next question is, how many of these offenders were caught and put to death?
So again, I mean, it's a much more complicated story than we perhaps know about when we think about Bonfire Night, because it's fairly well known that Guy Fawkes is apprehended. He's the first member of the plot to be captured. He's actually captured in the cellar underneath the House of Parliament, just as he's sort of preparing to light the fuse. So he is taken off and tortured. And of course, when the other plotters realise that Guy Fawkes has been taken and the game is up, they all set about fleeing London. And a group of them head up to Warwickshire and they end up at Holbeach House there, which belongs to a member of the Catholic gentry who's agreed to put them up. They are absolutely exhausted by this time. It takes them some days to get there. They're clearly under mental distress. And unfortunately, they manage to blow themselves up in Holbeach House, which sort of just adds to their misery. No one is actually killed, although one of the plotters, John Grant, is actually blinded in the explosion. So it's really, really ironic that the only explosion of the Gunpowder Plot actually blows up the conspirators. They then resolve, being led by Robert Catesby, to have a sort of heroic last stand. I suppose we can call it heroic. And when the king's men arrive, they come out and, you know they're going to die. And actually, Robert Catesby and another leading plotter, Thomas Percy, are actually killed with the same bullet, reportedly. The remaining members of the plot, including poor blind John Grant, are taken to the Tower of London. And most of them, along with Guy Fawkes, are then later executed.
So, Elizabeth, out of these 13 plotters, how many were put to death?
Eight of the plotters are actually executed. They're all sentenced to be hanged, drawn and quartered, which is the standard penalty for treason. And it's really intended to be a deterrent because you do not want to be hanged, drawn and quartered. In fact, Guy Fawkes, again, you know, the most famous member of the plot, actually has the most memorable death, because once the noose is round his neck to hang him for a little bit, just to sort of cause some pain before they start sort of chopping him up, he actually, with the noose around his neck, jumps from the scaffold and breaks his neck. So he actually saves himself the worst penalty.
Goodness. And there is this famous drawing of the plotters that many people might be familiar with, particularly school children who've probably come across it in a textbook or on the internet or something. It features a number of characters whose names you'll give us, obviously. But who features in this drawing? And also, who's missing?
It's a drawing of, it actually only depicts 8 of the conspirators rather than the 13 that we know. And it's actually the leading conspirators. So we've got Robert Catesby. We've got Thomas Percy, and he's a really important character to the plot. He's actually the oldest member of the conspiracy, but he's there right at the beginning. Thomas Percy is a cousin of the Earl of Northumberland, so very, very high ranking, but sort of a poor relation. And he has been sent north throughout the last years of Elizabeth's reign to go and talk to James VI of Scots, who's going to be Elizabeth's heir. And he feels very, very disappointed in how James intends to manage religion in England when he becomes king. So he joins the conspirators, and he's actually very, very close to Robert Catesby. Interestingly, Thomas Percy is actually, because of his connections, actually appointed one of King James's gentlemen pensioners, which essentially means he's one of the king's bodyguards, which actually gives the gunpowder plotters the reason to hire a cellar under the House of Parliament, because Thomas Percy needs to be close to London and to the court. So he is also depicted on the drawing. We've also, of course, got Guy Fawkes. We've got Kit and Jack Wright, who are leading conspirators. I mean, actually, they're schoolfellows of Guy Fawkes. They're quite likely to be the people that bring Guy into the plot. And we've got the Wintour brothers as well. So we've got all these leading conspirators. We've also got Bates, who is Robert Catesby's servant. He's actually the lowest ranking of the plotters. And again, is really brought in because of this relationship he has with Catesby, which we'll hear about with Francis Tresham as well. So these are sort of the leading conspirators. Francis Tresham, Sir Everard Digby, Ambrose Rookwood, some other of the later conspirators aren't even depicted because they're actually quite minor in the plot. They come in later.
I'm curious about this Thomas Percy connection to the king. How close was he to the king? Because it's a big effort to get together 12 other people to conspire with to blow up Parliament and the king. If he had close access to the king, why didn't he just carry out a basic assassination?
So this is one of the strangest parts about the plot, because actually many of the conspirators have access to the king. Guy Fawkes actually attends a wedding with James where he's wearing his sword. I mean, he easily could have run the king through. Robert Catesby goes hunting with the king not long before the plot is discovered. So they have so many opportunities to assassinate him. They're clearly looking to do something else. So yes, they want the king dead, but they also want to make a big show. They want to show the world, you know, what they've done. They want to blow up the political establishment, because of course it's not just the king who'll be in Parliament. And they also want to bring down the government. They don't want to just remove the head of the government. They want to remove the entire political establishment. So the Queen will be there, the Prince of Wales, all of the king's ministers, all of the nobility, the members of the Houses of Commons. So everyone will be there. So it's going to destroy the English government in one blow. And that's what they want.
I suppose in some respects it was too ambitious, really. It was over-ambitious for what it was. And then it literally, for some of the plotters, blew up in their face at Holbeach House. But let's get into the details then of this religious insurgency by Catholics in this period and try to understand why this feeling sprang up at the time. You touched on it a little bit. Why was it difficult to be a Catholic in England in the early 1600s?
So by 1605, it had actually been illegal to worship as a Catholic in England for nearly 50 years. So we always think about Elizabeth I for her sort of tolerance and the successes of her reign. But actually, although her religious settlement that she makes following the reign of her Catholic sister Mary is intended to be sort of a middle road to try and please many people, it really doesn't please the Catholics, because it makes it illegal to be a Catholic in England. And it's a legal requirement that you have to attend the Protestant parish church every Sunday. So it's really, really difficult to be a Catholic in Elizabeth's England and then in James's England, because you can't worship openly. You have to go to the Protestant parish church. So actually, Catholics really develop a number of strategies to cope. So some will go to the Protestant church and they're known as church papists. And actually they have some strategies to try and avoid this heretical service as they see it. So we have accounts of Catholics loudly saying their rosary when the Protestant service is going on, or getting up and walking at the back of the church with their hands over their ears so they can't hear. Because it's not really the path of least resistance, because as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, to attend a heretical service is to damn your soul. Another option for Catholics is to be a recusant, where you refuse to attend church. But actually, you can face some very severe punishments for this. You'll be fined for recusancy, and they're very high fines. So actually, most Catholics can't afford to be recusants for too long.
So was there someone taking a register at church services on Sundays to check that the local people were attending?
Yes, there is. The church wardens are supposed to report on who comes to church and who doesn't come to church. And so it sort of depends on the area. If it's quite a Catholic area, you may find that you're not being reported for recusancy, because actually the church wardens are quite Catholic themselves. But it really depends. A lot of great families are absolutely bankrupted by these fines.
So this is spying and mass surveillance of the general populace on a mass scale.
Yeah, and it's...
And that's no pun, by the way.
But it's really an attempt to bring people into the Church of England by sort of default, if you like. You may not get the parents, but if you make all the children come to church all through their lives, they'll probably grow up Protestant. And that's what the Elizabethan authorities are hoping for.
Very interesting. So what punishments could a Catholic face?
So you have the fines for recusancy. If you're a Catholic priest and you're caught, you will be executed, and they're normally hanged, drawn and quartered. So, you know, really unpleasant. If you're caught helping a priest, you can be imprisoned and also executed. And there are also sort of other penalties. Famously, there's Margaret Clitheroe, who is the wife of a butcher from York. I'm actually the city that Guy Fawkes comes from. And she is sentenced to be pressed to death under stones because she won't enter a plea of whether or not she's harbouring Catholic priests. So some of the treatment meted out to Catholics in the Elizabethan period can be very, very brutal.
Where do the roots of this religious insurgency by Catholics against the Protestant religion come from?
I think it's to some extent bred out of sort of hopelessness. They're hoping that if they change the government, that maybe they'll get a better result. You know, they're hoping for a Catholic government, or at least someone who is prepared to allow them to worship.
But I suppose my broader question was more about where this sort of stems from historically. Does this go back to Henry VIII's troubles with the Pope and this sort of thing?
It goes back to Henry VIII and his attempt to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. And of course, Catherine of Aragon doesn't go quietly. The Pope will not grant an annulment. And eventually, Henry breaks the English church away from the Church of Rome, so from the Pope, and declares himself supreme head of the church. And Henry's church is by no means Protestant, but he does make some changes to the church that are quite radical. But he continues to burn Protestants as heretics right up to the end of his reign, although he also hangs Catholics as traitors. So, you know, he's fairly fair in his treatment of people who are religious.
Or at least consistent.
He is quite consistent, yes. He actually does burn one Catholic as a heretic, but generally he hangs them. The Protestant Reformation really gets going in the reign of his son, Edward VI. And this is where you have to strip out all the church furniture and you have a new Book of Common Prayer, which is a Protestant service book. Edward dies after 6 years and Mary, his half-sister, becomes queen, and she returns England to the Church of Rome. So it becomes a Catholic country again. So Elizabeth I, her half-sister, inherits a Catholic country when she becomes queen in 1558, but she very quickly imposes her Protestant religious settlement. And it's not as staunchly Protestant as in her brother's reign. It is a bit of a middle way. And actually, she doesn't please everyone. She doesn't please the Puritans in her government, for example, who are very Calvinist and want a very sort of plain church. But it certainly doesn't please the Catholics. And Elizabeth is not a Catholic at all. And increasingly during her reign, Catholicism becomes associated with treason. So it becomes very, very difficult to be a Catholic in Elizabeth's reign.
So over the space of several decades, England is really, it's in crisis over its religious identity, all because of Henry VIII and him wanting to get an annulment and to split from Catherine of Aragon, his first wife.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically that. It's, I mean, the whole of Europe is undergoing religious turmoil at this point because Protestantism develops out of the writings of Martin Luther early in the 16th century. So Germany, for example, becomes very Protestant. But in France in the 16th century, we have the wars of religion where Protestants are fighting Catholics. And I mean, it's essentially a civil war. So it's not really just an English thing. What makes it unusual in England is that it's Catholics who are the persecuted group rather than Protestants.
But like a war, there's two sides and they're constantly going at each other, recovering ground that was previously lost and this sort of thing. It's kind of a war of attrition, isn't it?
It is. And what actually, I mean, Elizabethan literature, what they clearly find very, very sinister about Catholics is you can't actually tell if someone's a Catholic because people sort of suddenly reveal themselves. I mean, a really good example is Sir Thomas Stanley, who is Guy Fawkes's commander in the Spanish Catholic army in the Netherlands. And he's actually a really important English commander for years and years and years. And Robert Dudley, the Queen's favorite, actually says, you know, he's worth his weight in pearl. He's such a good commander. And then one day he just suddenly announces that he's a Catholic and takes his soldiers over to the Spanish. So Catholics are seen as very, very sinister to Elizabethans. They become sort of everybody's favorite bogeyman, if you like. People are genuinely quite scared of Catholics and they are seen as quite sort of insidious.
Duplicitous, potentially, as well.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
So James I, obviously the new king, had only recently come to the throne. James I of England, James VI of Scotland. How did James's accession to the throne of England affect Catholics?
Catholics were very, very hopeful about James. James was raised as a Protestant in Scotland, but he was the son of two Catholic parents. So he was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her Catholic second husband, Henry, Lord Darnley. So there were sort of hopes that although he hadn't been raised by his parents, this Catholicism would sort of have rubbed off on him. And James was determined to inherit the English throne. And it was by no means a certainty because Elizabeth didn't have an obvious successor. And so essentially he would tell Englishmen who came to him really what they wanted to hear to try and get them to support him. So when Thomas Percy heads north to go and meet with James before his accession, he goes with messages from his cousin Earl of Northumberland. James very much gives Thomas Percy the impression that he's going to be tolerant of Catholicism, you know, maybe even favour it. So Thomas Percy really has a crushing blow when it's quickly realised that actually James has no intentions of returning England to Catholicism or even of tolerating it. And actually toleration itself is a really difficult concept in the 16th and 17th centuries. It's not how we would use the word today. So when people call out for tolerance, they almost always only do it when they're a minority. And the reason for that is because actually, I mean, if there's only one correct way to worship God, which these different groups fervently believe there is, then how can you be tolerant? Because of course you have a God-given requirement to convert people to the true faith. So people will call for tolerance in the period, but actually really they don't exactly mean it. They want to be dominant. They want to be the religion that is in charge.
What did the plotters hope to achieve then with the gunpowder plot?
The plotters are hoping to entirely remove the Protestant government. They want to place James's daughter, Princess Elizabeth, who is a child, on the throne, presumably to marry her off to a good Catholic prince. And they then want to create a Catholic government to rule through her. So she'll effectively be a puppet queen. So they are intending to change the state religion by wiping out the government. So they want England to be a Catholic country. They're not looking for toleration or tolerance. They're looking for state Catholicism.
Does it logically follow, and this is a slightly off-piece question, if you destroy and dismember via gunpowder and explosions the king, that suddenly a relative is going to do what you say?
No, and this is actually the most harebrained part of the scheme. And it's not a very well thought out scheme, in fact. I mean, you know, its chances of success are pretty minimal. Because, of course, even if they do kill most of the government, they're not going to get all of the nobility because some people won't have come to Parliament for whatever reason. And so actually the chances of these sort of slightly random Catholic gentlemen being able to create their own government, they haven't got any Spanish backing, for example, which they've been seeking. So the chance of them actually creating this government is really unlikely. Even if they acquire Princess Elizabeth, they are unlikely to be able to create this new Catholic state.
Andrew, you're listening to this. Let's obviously focus now on Francis Tresham and Rushton Triangular Lodge and how this fits into the wider context of the Gunpowder Plot. So Francis Tresham is not a name that many people will be familiar with, and he doesn't feature in that famous drawing that we described earlier with Elizabeth. So who was Francis and how does he fit into this story?
Francis Tresham, like Catesby, is a Northamptonshire gentleman, and he hails from Rushton, which is just north of Kettering. And he's the eldest son of Sir Thomas Tresham and Muriel Throckmorton. And like his parents, he is a dedicated Catholic. However, unlike his father and his mother, who remain loyal subjects throughout their life, he is determined to actively rebel against the crown. So he was, for example, one of the followers of the Earl of Essex during his rebellion against Elizabeth in 1601. And as a result of this, he is arrested and imprisoned in the Tower, and actually costs the Treshams a considerable sum of 3,000 marks, and no little influence to actually have him freed after that.
And what was Tresham's relationship with the other plotters?
Well, after his imprisonment, this doesn't seem to warn him off rebelling. So he continues to dabble in treason. He has, and it's through this these activities that he makes contact with one of the other plotters in Guy Fawkes. They are both part of a group of Catholics who attempt to get the King of Spain to sponsor rebellion in England in 1603. But he only gets involved in the Gunpowder Plot relatively late on the 14th of October. And this is because he is the first cousin of Catesby, who, as we've heard, is the main instigator of the plot. And this is probably due to the fact that Francis's father, Thomas, has just died, and Catesby seems to have a bit of an eye on Tresham's inheritance as a means of funding the plot.
Very interesting. It's always good to have land, isn't it, in this time period?
Yeah, and the Treshams are fabulously wealthy. They're one of the wealthiest families in Northamptonshire.
Right. You've mentioned Catesby there a couple of times, Andrew, a key instigator, a key plotter. Elizabeth, you had some points to make about him as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, what really comes out with Robert Catesby through the testimony of all of the plotters is just how sort of magnetic his personality is. He's a really good-looking man. He's over 6 foot tall. And everybody seems to have liked him. He has a huge circle of friends. He's particularly dominant over his cousin Francis Tresham. And in some ways, that's quite surprising because he's younger than Tresham. But there are accounts of them in childhood where it's really Catesby who is taking the lead and Francis follows. So even though actually Francis Tresham seems to have had serious doubts about the Gunpowder Plot, he still enters into it. And I think we can thank Catesby for that. But I think he's so compelling that people just join his plot, even when they don't actually believe it can succeed.
And I suppose the familial connection, what with them being cousins, was quite a pull as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also really important in that kinship is very, very important, particularly to the gentry in Tudor and Jacobean England.
Yes, it's intrinsic to loyalty, isn't it?
It is. I mean, he certainly wouldn't want to be informing on Catesby. And of course, once he knows about the plot, as far as the authorities are concerned, he's in the plot.
Yes, and he can't really escape from it, as I think we'll end up discussing. But focusing on his asset, this triangular lodge, which belongs to Francis Tresham and his family, what does it tell us about the Treshams as a family, Andrew?
Well, Rushton Triangular Lodge was constructed about a decade prior to the plot in 1596. And it's fairly modest, fairly small kind of hunting lodge in the middle of the Tresham's Rushton estates. But it's one of the most strikingly decorated Tudor lodges in Britain. Now, normally these lodges were built as kind of destinations for hunting parties, as eye catchers within the landscape, or else to house practical functions. So it's ostensibly a warrenry, a centre of a large rabbit farm, but its exterior decoration reveals, I guess, an alternative story of Catholic faith and suppression of Elizabethan England, one that is very personal to the Treshams and particularly to Francis's father, Thomas. Thomas Tresham was the lodge's architect. He was brought up as a Protestant, but he converted to Catholicism in 1580, thanks to a mission of Jesuit priests who were attempting to essentially regenerate the Roman Catholic Church in Britain. And Thomas was one of their most important converts. He becomes an ardent Catholic and one of the recusants we've been hearing about who refused to attend Anglican services. And as a result of this, he incurs some of those steep fines that we've heard about, around about £8,000, which is quite a large amount of money, not quite enough to really embarrass the family financially, as they're very wealthy, but nevertheless a considerable drain upon his resources. But more damaging still, he actually took part in hiding a Jesuit priest, a man called Edmund Campion, in 1581. And for this, he's sentenced to 7 years in prison. And this is one of a number of stretches that he spends either in prison or else under house arrest, severely limiting his life and his career. What's quite interesting about Thomas is that, unlike his son and the members of the plot, who are obviously very militant in their resistance, he tried to express and practice his Catholic faith while also arguing that one could be loyal to the crown as head of state. And indeed, he even tries to make that case unsuccessfully to Elizabeth. Instead, he settles for using the lodge as a profession of faith set out in stone.
I see. So kind of this physical demonstration of not agreeing with the status quo as handed down by the head of state.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even that must have been pretty controversial. I'm surprised he wasn't told to take it down.
Well, yes. I mean, it's partly controversial and partly not controversial. So while in prison in Ely, Thomas works out a whole scheme of kind of emblems and symbols and cryptograms and mottos, which are going to adorn essentially the exterior of the lodge, which you can see today. And this is kind of a general reflection for an Elizabethan love of buildings or paintings or poems with kind of hidden or different, you know, overlapping meanings, things that they called essentially kind of devices more broadly. And to really understand them, you have to be in possession of the kind of like insider knowledge and be able to sort of puzzle it out. And many of these things are kind of uncontroversial. It's kind of the sort of thing that gentlemen did, albeit on a slightly more kind of larger scale. You know, many of them are really about presenting his personal identity and kind of ostensibly looks like it's a kind of a statement of his sort of family identity and family ties. So, for example, there are various ways in which he references his name or else incorporates emblems of his family, such as coats of arms and things. And then the most obvious aspect of the lodge, the fact that it's a triangle, is part of an expression and an affinity that he's trying to present with the Holy Trinity, which is very uncontroversial at this point. So the lodge itself is one of the reasons why it's so striking is that it is a three-sided hunting lodge, and it's very precise in terms of its measurements. So it's 33.3 feet wide, and there are various visual emblems that are based upon threes. And then to sort of bring all of that together, there's some cunning wordplay connecting Tresham with the Holy Trinity. So the words above the entrance are in Latin, tres, T-R-E-S, testimonium dant, which is a reference to a passage in the Bible, which translates as, for there are three that bear record, or in threes we testify. This refers to the Trinity, of course, but also to Tresham, because his nickname is Tres. So you have that kind of little bit of overlapping meanings, different meanings. So you've got it to the Trinity, but it's also Tresham, and it's a triangular lodge, and it's all kind of fairly harmless, clean fun as far as these things go. So ostensibly, you can kind of pass this off as a kind of a fairly harmless expression of family and fairly uncontroversial beliefs. But then, generally, the kind of the higher up the building you go, the motifs and the symbols become slightly more esoteric, and then slightly more controversial. So the Virgin Mary, worship of the Virgin Mary is frowned upon in this period, and yet there are various concealed references to her in the form of cryptograms, i.e. numbers standing for letters, and indeed symbols. So he uses the symbol of a dove to reference her. And then even more dangerous than that, there are references to the rite of Mass, the Catholic rite of Mass, which is prohibited in this period. So there is a chalice, for example, carved on the southwestern side, representing the vessel containing the wine that, according to Catholic belief, not Protestant belief, is transformed into the blood of Christ at the Mass. So in sum, the lodge is this means of kind of resisting and professing his faith, keeping his faith alive during a time when it's highly dangerous to do so. And really alongside a very large library of Catholic books, some of which are prohibited, that Tresham collects, the lodge is supposed to be this Catholic legacy. He's trying to keep this kind of faith alive in Northamptonshire. However, he dies in 1605, and Francis being involved in the plot means that there's actually going to be a very different type of legacy connected with the Treshams.
It sort of implicates, the lodge kind of implicates Francis as the son in a much stronger way, I suppose, due to what his father has built. I suppose it makes Francis look a bit more controversial, just by association, maybe.
I'm not sure. I think it's well known that they're recusants. It's well known that they're Catholics. I think that Thomas just about walks a very, very narrow line, a very fine margin between professing his faith and potentially suffering the ultimate consequences. Whereas Francis, through his own actions, is actually going to sort of topple off that precipice.
Well, let's talk about how Francis Tresham is eventually caught as one of the 13 plotters. What goes down?
It seems that, and we have Guy Fawkes' testimony for this, that Francis is trying to urge the other plotters to abandon their scheme. He seems to be concerned for the safety of the Catholic peers who are going to attend Parliament, and he's not convinced by Catesby's assurances that they will be safe. And then at the end of October, William Parker, who's Lord Monteagle, who's former Catholic and a Catholic sympathiser, receives an anonymous letter warning him not to attend Parliament and asking him to burn the letter. Instead, he takes it to the King's right-hand man, the Earl of Salisbury, and this essentially gives up the game. So this reveals the fact that there is something going on. However, Catesby decides that they're going to continue anyway and that this is not going to threaten their plans.
An element of hubris, perhaps, or just very strong conviction in his own plan, I suppose.
Seems to be in keeping with the man, doesn't it, Elizabeth?
It does, really, yes.
Okay, so do we have a passage from this letter?
Yes, yeah, so I'll read out the crucial passage, and it reads thus. My lord, out of the love I bear to some of your friends, I have a care of your preservation. Therefore, I would advise you, as you tender your life, to devise some excuse to shift off your attendance at this Parliament. For God and man hath concurred to punish the wickedness of this time. They shall receive a terrible blow, this Parliament, and yet they shall not see who hurts them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite powerful stuff. It's not subtle, is it? So there have been various names put forward as to the author of the letter, but I think it's likely, given his recorded reluctance to engage with the plot and the fact that he's Monteagle's brother-in-law, that the letter came from Sir Francis Tresham.
Goodness me.
He's clearly the obvious candidate, isn't he?
It sounds to me, and I think maybe listeners are probably nodding their heads in agreement as well. How does that letter implicate him if he didn't sign it with his own name?
Well, he's not so much implicated by the letter. He's actually named as a conspirator by Guy Fawkes after his incarceration. And as a result of that, he's then committed to the Tower. And while at first he tries to sort of evade any kind of admission of involvement, he then later tries to sort of spin it as him kind of being involved, but trying to frustrate the plan. But, you know, clearly by, I think as Elizabeth mentioned earlier, by being involved or knowing about it and not then doing something about it, he is definitely complicit.
And that's treason.
Yes, and that's treason, yeah, absolutely. And then he admits to having prior involvement in the plot to try and engage Philip of Spain in rebellion. But he dies and essentially escapes the brutal punishment meted out on his fellow plotters. But because his actions are treated as treason, he is posthumously attainted, i.e. stripped of property and titles, and his head is displayed in Northampton as a warning to others.
Yes, and just to recap his fate, Elizabeth, you mentioned he had ill health in the Tower of London, but can you give us a quick recap of how he died?
Yeah, so he doesn't seem to have been particularly well before. I think it's some sort of digestive complaint or something like that, but he falls ill quite quickly, and the authorities do make attempts to make him better. I mean, actually, once they've got the information from the prisoners they want, and of course Guy Fawkes is very severely tortured, but once the authorities have the information, the plotters are actually treated quite well in the Tower because the authorities want to get them through to their executions. They want to make a real show of what happens if you try to blow up the king. So Tresham is actually well treated. His wife is allowed to come and nurse him. You know, he's given medicines. They attempt to keep him alive. And unfortunately, or actually probably in his case, fortunately, he dies in the Tower.
So I suppose for Tresham, for someone who wasn't completely wanting to be involved in the plot and almost was this unsuccessful double agent, this reluctant hero or anti-hero, you could say, his fate was kind of apt in a way that he just sort of died of a unknown illness in the Tower, having been arrested, whilst the others, who were a bit more fervent in their desire to blow up the king, had a bit more aggressive and more suitable punishments, I guess you could say. I think that's an interesting part of the story, at least.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, he's certainly not the most guilty in the plot. I mean, really does very little, partly because he comes in so late and he's also quite reluctant to be involved. So, I mean, it's really, really unfortunate for him that he is Catesby's cousin and that Catesby has his eye on his inheritance, because otherwise I think, you know, he probably would have stayed clear of the plot.
Yes, and inheritance is the key thing because, as you say, Catesby had his eye on the Rushton Triangular Lodge. Catesby was executed himself. So, and Andrew, you mentioned that the lodge obviously went out of the hands of the Treshams. So who got hold of it after?
Well, the lodge is one part of the large estate of Rushton, which is just one of the Treshams' estates. The family basically keeps them basically on a technicality because of the way in which it was passed to Francis meant that actually when he died, it automatically went to his brother Louis. So it kind of escapes the clutches of the crown. However, within a few years, the family's fortunes really wane, partly as a consequence of Thomas's considerable debts, and the estate essentially has to be sold off anyway, and it passes through various private hands, where it remains to this day. And so the lodge itself kind of remains within view of Rushton Hall, which is now a hotel, but it's kind of a little bit marooned from the rest of the state, but still beautifully preserved.
And you can drive past it. I think it's right by a road, isn't it?
Yeah, it's right by a road. There's places to park, and it's accessible by visitors in the visiting season.
That's something that people can look forward to when the visiting season starts again. And perhaps they might want to coordinate with a quick listen to this podcast episode as they walk around. Have you visited, either of you, and how are you struck by the building?
Yes, I've visited a number of times and have worked on some of the site presentation that we're producing there. I think it's a miniature masterpiece, in my opinion. It's really this kind of singular expression of identity and faith through architecture. And although it's born of suffering, of persecution, of incarceration, and indeed is a kind of a very polemical statement of Catholicism, there is also a certain lightness, a certain joy to the experience of the lodge. I think particularly because although it is kind of a little bit oblique, it's a little bit, the meanings are hidden, it's great that he has this broad canvas, Thomas has this broad canvas to express himself. And he does so with dashes of humour and playfulness and a great flair for architectural design. And I think for the visitor, it's really fun to kind of figure out what the symbols mean. We talked a little bit about some of the ones that are easiest to understand in kind of abstract terms, but actually there are many there that you need to be there to understand. And you can kind of have this process of kind of wrestling with the meaning of the building. You have to stand in certain places to see certain symbols. You have to move around to understand the messages that kind of run across the whole building. And then tantalizingly, there are some designs and symbols that we just don't know the meaning of and are open to interpretation.
Yes, I believe there are some four-digit figures that are a bit mysterious.
Yeah, there are a few numbers where there have been various proposals as to what they actually mean, and I don't think any of them are particularly compelling.
What are your thoughts, Elizabeth? Have you visited?
I have on several occasions. And I mean, I think it's a wonderful place. As Andrew says, it's really Thomas Tresham's canvas. And you can sort of see inside the mind of an Elizabethan Catholic to some extent here. And it's such a fascinating building. I mean, I would go so far and say, actually, it's one of my favourite English heritage properties. It's only small, it's really, really tiny. But just on a general level, it's beautiful. But then you sort of, you look at it and every time you go, you see something new. And the codes and the images are, I mean, they're really, really difficult to understand, but you sort of, it gives you a sense of what life was like for Catholics, which is very, very difficult in Elizabeth's reign.
I think another thing that people will appreciate if they're mathematically minded is just how intricate and mathematically meticulous the property is. Because if anyone's seen plans, which they may like to do by opening up a new tab on their browser right now, if they look at the designs in plan, it's really, really detailed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And he does a lot of the work on designing it while he's incarcerated. He sketches out some of the designs on the walls of Ely Prison, or else he has... There are various manuscripts in the British Library which show his thoughts, you know, and he writes out what his plans are, he makes the measurements and kind of plans it in intricate detail.
How does Francis Tresham, Thomas Tresham, his father, and Rushton Triangular Lodge, how do they all relate and give us a better sense of what Bonfire Night really means?
So I would say that Rushton specifically doesn't so much reflect the gunpowder plot, but it does help to reveal a kind of a more nuanced hinterland behind the much more familiar stories of overt Catholic resistance and indeed the punishment for that resistance. It really speaks to religious expression and the consequence of that for many of the Catholics in England. Thomas is trying to ride this sort of middle road between tacit acceptance of the status quo and the overt militancy and rebellion of Francis and his fellow plotters. And more broadly, I think the Lodge is a fascinating case study in faith, its centrality to self-identity, and how vital it is to be able to express that faith.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll be looking at the stories behind some of London's most poignant war memorials ahead of Remembrance Day.
Here was a royal fellowship of death. And when you look at the end of it, you just see that word death and then the corpse on top. It's terribly powerful and a frank depiction of the casualties that were incurred.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.